Hi, you're listening to a Pod for Good Media Network podcast. We are a network that provides podcasting production services and a supportive community in which podcasters can thrive. If you're a podcaster local in the Tulsa area, we would love to have your show on the network. If you are interested in starting one, we would love to help you get started. Find us online at podforgoodmedia.com and fill out our Pod With Us form. Happy podcasting.
Another episode of In Depth with Dion. In this episode, I speak with Cody Ransom, a Greenwood tour guide, music artist, youth coach, and owner of Black Wall Street Liquid Lounge, about how we reclaim the spirit of Greenwood during a time of division inside and outside our communities. But first, the rundown. In local news, Tulsa's first Black mayor, Monroe Nichols, has announced his final picks for his administration in what's shaping up to be one of the most diverse, equitable, and inclusive administrations in the city's history. Mayor Nichols has tapped Dr. Jabron Pasha, a nationally recognized professional, to be the senior advisor of health, and Brentum Todd, an accomplished community development professional who will serve as deputy chief of staff. In state news, a bill to make it easier for people with criminal convictions to earn a college degree has made it to the Oklahoma House floor after passing two committees with bipartisan support. HB 1980, the Oklahoma Higher Education Fair Admissions Act, would ban colleges and universities from asking applicants about their criminal history as long as the applicant plans to attend virtually and won't live on campus. And in national news, stock prices for Target continue to fall 6 weeks after its decision to drop DEI initiatives, which resulted in nationwide boycotts. A 40-day fast against the retailer started just Wednesday, March 5th. According to the NASDAQ Stock Exchange, Target's stock price fell from a high of $142.50 on January 27th to a high of $118.22 on Tuesday, March 4th. It represents a 17% drop since the last high after it abandoned its diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. And those are some of the headlines. This is In Depth with Dion. I'm your host, Dion Osborne, recording from Tulsa's historic Greenwood District. And up next, you'll hear directly from Cody Ransom. All right, Cody Ransom. I have to just list this out because I can't keep track of it all. You're an owner of Black Wall Street's famous Liquid Lounge. You're a historian. You give guided tours of Black Wall Street for people across the country and across the world. You're a youth sports trainer, coach, a poetic rapper, and community leader. What did I miss?
Insomniac, workaholic. I like to think of myself as I know how to do a whole lot of little stuff, you know. I know how to do the things that I love. And so, you nailed it. You're right on point. Yeah.
All right. So, you know, you are the first face kind of a lot of people see when they come to Greenwood looking to understand and learn the history. I guess to start off, how did you become the owner of Liquid Lounge? What motivated you to want to become an entrepreneur? And talk a little bit about, you know, your upbringing growing up here.
Yeah, my business partner, Guy Troop, and his wife, they started the Liquid Lounge. It was actually Bobby Eaton Sr., Poppy Eaton, that got me into the space. So one of his sons, Dwight, was also one of the founding members of it. And so when I came in, it felt older, you know what I mean? It just kind of had that vibe to it. But Poppy Eaton brought me down, and he was like, man, I think you would be great down here. And so I just kind of started helping out here and there. Wasn't on payroll or anything like that. And then all of a sudden, I think a few months in, Guy Troop was just like, hey, you want to own it? And I'm like, what's the catch? And he was just like, I only asked that if you ever get tired of it or you ever done, just pass it down to somebody else. So he was like, I'm going to stay on board, help you out any way I can. I was in oil and gas. And so, yeah, just having a job, I didn't like it. It was mainly because by the time I got off work, I didn't have the energy to do the stuff that I really wanted to do. And so that would have been 2020 in the middle of COVID. So it was, something told me to go sit on Greenwood. That's what I did. Ran into Tony Williams, my brother Paige, and we just sat on the benches for months with nothing to do. And Liquid Lounge just kind of fell in my lap, you know? And so being there, it immediately felt like home. And so I wanted to be able to create that same vibe to where when people came from out of town, they didn't feel like they were coming to a museum or coming to a gravesite. They actually felt like they were coming to visit family. Mm. And so that's kind of how it built up. Being here, growing up in North Tulsa, we had spots like that. When I was a kid, it was going to Lacey Park or go to O'Brien Park. Some of the older men who worked there, number one, they got on your tail, but number two, they took care of you. You know, the communities kind of took care of us. And right. So I wanted to make sure that, you know, looking around the landscape, it wasn't a lot of that. You know, everything is geared around business. So being an entrepreneur is about making money, but ultimately it's, I like to think that people shop with you because they like you, not necessarily because of the product. I like to shop with people I like, you know, and so the more I get to know the people, you know, it's no one walks into a McDonald's and asks, you know, who owns this McDonald's? Right. But the owner should be able to stand in there and represent the product that they sell. And so people being able to walk into the Liquid Lounge and see that either myself or Guy Troop's going to be behind the counter, that's something I think is pretty unique. Most people, when they own something, they kind of want to take the back seat and let other people run it. But it's a collaborative thing. My employees can tell me what to do, same way I can tell them what to do. And so it's a collaborative thing. And I think being on Greenwood specifically, that's the way business should work down there. And so I wanted to make sure that when people came to Greenwood, they're not just witnessing a history. They're watching us kind of replicate that same thing.
Mm. I mean, I've had the famous Purple Rain, I've come in many times where you yourself were sometimes the only one, you know, doing all these orders. Yeah. And so like you lead by example, you know, the authenticity, I'll say, you know, I moved to Tulsa first in 2018, moved back home to Lawton during the pandemic to figure things out. And then I ended up moving back to work for the Black Wall Street Times full time. And coming on Greenwood, you were the face I kept seeing. And the authenticity was what really led me to want to kind of, I've been watching you from afar before we even had a first conversation, you know, because for me, as someone who's not from Tulsa, let alone, you know, North Tulsa, Greenwood, covering these stories, covering other people's lives, I want to learn how to move and how, you know, to be authentic and who do I need to look to who's moving like that. Mm-hmm. And so you were someone who helped me, you know, navigate this job and, you know, entering the community in an authentic way as an outsider. And so, you know, I respect you for that. When it comes to the tours, you know, there's plenty of organizations and several different people who give tours of Black Wall Street. You have plenty of documentaries now since just in the last few years, you know, if you wanted to just learn about it from your phone or from the comfort of your home. We got the museum now, which, you know, there's, you know, lots of stuff, you know, criticisms and accolades surrounding that. But you are the people come to see. You are the one people come to see when they say, if you want to know about the real history, go see Cody. Why is that? And what is it that you're telling people that they can't get elsewhere?
I think it's because of the way I think about history and also just the way I think about myself. My granny used to always say, in life, you'll never be right. You'll never be wrong. And so the concept of that is like my job is just to understand. It's not to convince you to believe the way I do or for you to convince me. It's literally just for me to lay out what I know. You lay out what you know. And then we could part ways from that. And so being in Greenwood, the museum is something that could be controversial if you talk to some people. It's inspirational to other people. And so me being able to operate in that middle of, yes, there are holes. There are things that are missing inside of the museum. But I also see that as a chance for us to be empowered to teach that and to fill in those gaps. So I don't say do the museum independently. I don't say do a walking tour independently. I think that between the cultural center, Greenwood Rising, and walking tours, that's what you need. And I think another reason that happens because Chief Amusan gives great tours. Terry Backus gives great tours. The difference, I think, would be I'm literally there every single day. And so it's sometimes you have to schedule with them. I'm literally a person that if you just walk into the coffee shop, if I'm not busy, we can leave right then. Mm-hmm. And so just that accessibility of being able to do it. But also I don't teach trauma. You know, you have to cover the massacre, of course, but I'm a person that's like, well, why did they build it? Who built it? You know, and then what happened to it? Mm-hmm. And then why did that happen to it? And what's something comparable to it? So digging into Greenwood's history, you start seeing like, oh, wait, Pine Bluff, Arkansas had a lot to do with Greenwood being built. And then that happens to be where O.W. Gurley moves from. Mm-hmm. And then you look at, oh, well, Pine Bluff, Arkansas became a place because of Robert Church and what he built in Memphis, Tennessee with Beale Avenue. So I'm like, oh, okay. So all of these histories actually tie in together versus just looking at it as, oh man, they really burned all of this. It's like, yeah, but in order to burn, you know, 197 businesses, someone has to build 197 businesses. So documentaries don't cover that story. And so I think that being in Greenwood, that authenticity part is, like I literally sit there and listen to the elders and then I find stuff that line up with what they say, you know? And so I don't teach the history in a way that I want you to feel bad or I want you to cry on this tour. It's just, I want you to leave here knowing that people did amazing things in this area and people come from all over the world to hear about our home. And so that should come with a certain level of pride and they come to experience Greenwood however they can. And so, if there's one person on the block that can do it, it's like, then I'll do it. You know, hopefully it'll kind of spark something in the other people that's on the block to see that, yes, we have to do business. Commerce is a part of it, but community was the main part of Greenwood. It didn't, right. You know, it's not as if you could walk down Greenwood and not spend a penny and everybody would hate you. It's like, you didn't always spend money in these businesses. Civil rights era, you didn't always get a haircut when you went in the barbershop. Sometimes it was the conversation that you had there. And so that's what we try to recreate at the Liquid Lounge. And that's what I recreate with tours. So I start my tours off the same way by telling people this will not feel like a history class. I fell asleep in every last one of those. So I like to feel like I'm talking to family. So I also did it for free for a little over 3 years. And that was my way of saying, you know what, before I take anything from this block, mm-hmm. I have to make sure I give something to it. Mm-hmm. And so those free tours were, hey, bring me a receipt showing me that you shopped at a business in Greenwood and I'll take you on a tour. It doesn't matter if you bought a water bottle or a rubber band. And so that became still a part of my tour. You actually get a discount for shopping with the businesses and it's not just specifically mine. And so I think that people seeing that you can be a human and do commerce, sometimes we think we have to do one or the other. It's like, no, that human aspect into what you do has to be prominent on that block. And I think that's what kind of pushed me towards the top over there.
Mm. No, it's real. It's real because, you know, I mean, even for me, you know, back in my activism days, I kind of developed this idea that if I'm making money, like I'm doing something that is unethical or I'm being unethical by trying to make money, right? You know, and it's a false, you know, it's a false choice. Because what you just described was the people who built the foundation of what we're standing on, you know, were in both lanes.
Yeah.
You know, I want you to talk about what's next for the Greenwood Art Gallery and what you're doing to repurpose it for people of all backgrounds and ages who want to get involved creatively.
Mm-hmm. So the new place we'll be putting inside of where the Greenwood Gallery used to be. It's called Greenwood Griots, home of Sanu. So, of course, a griot is a storyteller. Sanu in Middle Egyptian actually means friend or companion. Mm-hmm. So it's a space for story hub and storytelling. History gets to live there, but also content creation. So we all know, you know, media powers the world. And a lot of times the stories of everyday people are not captured. People think you have to be an amazing athlete or amazing musician before people care about your story. And so being able to capture that and show that like literally every civilization, every community is a collective of multiple stories, right? And so that's all we do when we're telling Greenwood's history. We're just telling you the stories of people. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people just don't know how to tell their own story. It's you have to ask certain questions to get things to come out of people. And so teaching people how to do that and empowering them to use their voices is kind of what we wanted the spot to be. And so, again, I wanted it to be independent of myself. I didn't want it to be something that you walk in and this is Cody. I wanted it to be you walk in and maybe I'm halfway across the country and it still has that same feeling. So the photographers that work in there, Joe and Kelly, Top Shot Photography, they're completely independent. So I don't tell them what to do. They create the experience they want people to have, which is pretty amazing. And then Aaron Michael King controls podcasting. So those are things that if I wanted to kind of lean into my capitalism side, I could do those things on my own. I know how to use a camera. I know how to shoot, act. I can do that. But it's not a passion. It's something I just know how to do. And so this is a passion for these people. And so it's like, okay, well, why not collaborate, come together and do that? And so I also want people to be able to see all of the different things that take place in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Right now, it depends on who you follow. It's kind of all scattered around. And so you have to look on, I know me, if I'm trying to find something to do for the weekend, it's like 5-6 different groups I have to go in and piece it all together. And so we wanted to be able to have a spot to where you could literally come in and see, like, this is what May looks like in Greenwood. This is what June looks like. These are the events coming up at the Gathering Place. Excuse me. These are events coming up in Greenwood, Brookside, any of that. So if you have the content, it's a place where you can house it. And so it's literally just meant to promote everything, because one thing about Greenwood is, even though Greenwood was kind of segregated to its own little area, the people of Greenwood were not. So they did go into Tulsa. Their commerce did trickle into Tulsa. So Greenwood was a hub of commerce back then. So why not be that now? When people come to Tulsa, Greenwood is one of the main places they go. And so also showing those people that grow up in North Tulsa, people that are from here, they've never seen Greenwood in its heyday and its prominence.
Right.
And so this is a way to be able to recreate that. So the walls are kind of themed around a philosophy I live by, which is build with, build for, learn from. So build with is it's a wall of collaboration. It just shows all of the different people that collaborate in this area. And then the build for is the younger generation. Like they need certain foundations to be built in order to be successful later. And so that build for wall will just be kid art. Whatever they want to create, it'll be there. And then we have the learn from wall, which is all history. Mm-hmm. So it's showing that all of those things should exist. So who are the people that are collaborating? Who are they collaborating for? And who did they learn it from? That's something we should all be doing before we build anything. We should know what was here before, you know, what we want it to be when it's finally finished, and who's going to be using it now. Mm-hmm. And so having that story hub to where you could literally pull up a QR code and I could look at Devin's story. I could look at Wayman Tisdale's story. I can look at just any people and listen to their story from their words, you know? And so one of the things we want to specialize in is capturing stories of elders. So elders are always free. We'll record their stuff. I experienced it once where a lady was passing away, but instead of writing a book, she did a short form documentary. And she said she did it because she wanted her kids to hear it from her words, not reading a book in their own voice, but actually hear her say it and see in her face which part she was most passionate about that she spoke about. So that's when I was like, oh, we don't have that, you know? And so stories rule the world. It's communities and everyday people that make it happen. Being a musician, I can be as great as I want to be if there's nobody in the crowd. This was just an audition or a practice, you know? So it's the what made these people come to this concert? What made these people come to the Greenwood District? You know, what made them come to Tulsa, Oklahoma? Mm-hmm. And so once they explain that story, you'll probably find some synergies in what you're trying to do. And so now it's a way that you connect people. And so as they leave, they can tell their friends and family, I want to go back to Greenwood because I met people there. Like, I know the stories of people there. That creates a community, not just I sold you a coffee, you got a coffee, and then you left. So that's what Greenwood Griots be about.
That's powerful. It's powerful. And I think it's going to be extremely powerful for those little ones, you know, who just, like you said, you know, it's something for people to have something to do. You know, because I think about a lot of people who, you know, went down the, you know, quote unquote, wrong track or whatever, when a lot of times it was because they didn't have anything to do or they didn't have the right thing that they knew to do. And they were following people who, you know, weren't doing what they should have been doing. Mm-hmm. I think about my brother who, you know, he passed away in 2019 from an overdose.
Sorry to hear that.
And the wild thing about it is that, you know, leading up to that, the last few months, he was really getting things on track, you know, and he ended up, you know, hanging out with some of the people who got him off track in the first place. And I always think about, like, if there was a hub, a place for him to go to where he could freely just explore his creative interests, whether that is something that he uses in a career later or just something that he just does for fun, like a hobby, you know, just those, something as simple as having somewhere to go to do something can be life-changing for a lot of people, especially a lot of people in our communities. Talk a little bit about your creative interests. I feel like there's a lot of people who still don't actually know your background in music. You know, so that's wild to me. Like, you don't really promote yourself that much in that lane, but talk about that. How did that come about?
Ooh, I guess that's where you and I are similar. It's the same way with how you were with activism and feeling like making money off of it felt bad. I'm kind of the same way with self-promotion. So I got my first recording contract when I was 13. And so originally I rapped. And back then I had literally no boundary. I would just rap about whatever.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, I like Lil Wayne, you know. So Lil Wayne would say the most random stuff. And I was just like, oh yeah, that's tight. I want to do that. And so I didn't think about how powerful the words I was using were. And then one time my cousin, Aaron, so she lives in Ghana, and she heard a project I did when I was maybe 16, 17. And she was like, yeah, this is a really good project for somebody else. She was like, but for you, I expected more. She was like, you know, you're smart. The things you know, how come none of those things are in here? This is just all... This sounds like someone who's never been exposed to anything. And so that's when I really, you know, kind of took a dive into looking at what I was doing. She gave me some songs to listen to. It was some songs from Black Thought, Talib Kweli, who else? Common, Nas. And at the time, I only listened to, I think it was like DJ Screw, like Houston music. Yeah, I was all South, you know, so.
Trying to get chrome.
So like those were boring songs to me at first. And then the more I started listening to them, I was like, this is more what I want to do. And so I kind of started doing that. And then it moved to Atlanta, lived there for a while, moved there to be a rapper, ended up being a songwriter. I was actually staying in my car for a little minute and working at a studio, ran into an artist who needed a song written. So I wrote it like it was my own song. I recorded it and sold it. And that was my first glimpse at, wait, I don't have to live the rapper lifestyle. I can just write a song and give it up, give it away. I'm like, this, oh yeah, this is perfect. So that's kind of what I started doing. And then my granny told me one time, she had asked me to write a blues record. I was like, I can't write blues. She was like, yeah, you can. Blues is the core of every song. Whether you do country, R&B, pop, rap. She was like, blues is at the core of all of it. And so that's when it was like, okay, I can start writing music without a beat. And if I do that, the drums is really what makes it whatever genre you want it to be. And so I started just telling stories about people. I think one of the things that went viral in Tulsa, at least, is I did a project where I was redoing all of Tupac's classics. And this lady online, I had asked, like, what Tupac classic should I do? And I can't remember what her name was, but I do remember her words. And her words were, I don't care what song you do, just don't touch Brenda's Got a Baby.
I don't know why I knew you were going to say that.
And I was like, fine, that's the one I'm going to do. Like, but then I listened to his story and I couldn't rewrite it, you know, better than what Tupac created. So I said, okay, well then what if I tell the story about what happens to the baby after the baby's put in the dumpster? So then I wrote the story from that perspective. And so it just kind of grew from there. Songs I've written have had Grammy nominations. I was nominated for a Hollywood Music Award, Hollywood Music and Media Award. That was 2021. I've never won, but it was just to know that like stuff I've written got out. Yeah. And so it was.
You kidding me? A Grammy nomination. That's a win.
Yeah. So it was, it's pretty cool, you know? And then I didn't realize how big Tulsa was in music, you know, growing up here. And then crazy story is one of my good friends, Taylor Hansen. I didn't know Taylor Hansen was Taylor Hansen for a couple of years. Like, and then someone asked him for an autograph, and I was just like,
what you doing?
Yeah, like I knew Taylor from Food on the Move.
Mm.
And so just seeing like, wait a minute. I was like, wait, you Bop Taylor. He was like, duh. Like
where you been?
Yeah, I never knew.
That's wild.
He started also helping me connect, you know, with the Recording Academy and stuff like that. I think I don't talk about it a lot just because at the end of the day, I'm still here in Tulsa. I'm in Greenwood. I'm not touring the world. Like I do music more. It's just something fun for me.
Outlet.
And, yeah, it's an outlet. And the moment I think it becomes a job, I'll probably not like it. Mm-hmm. And so because of accolades and not necessarily because of talent, people will lean on you more. So it's like if you know that he's had nominations, he's done A, B, and C, that's who we need to book. And it's like, no, like you should book me if you actually like the art, not right. because of what I've done.
What's the message?
Yeah. And so that's why I was just like, you know, like if you know, you know. And so every once in a while, someone will call me to do a cipher or something like that, and I'll do it. And people come in the coffee shop like, I didn't know you rap. I'm like, yeah, I've kind of been rapping longer than you've been alive, but okay, you know. But I love that. I love that aspect of it because it really shows that, you know, artists are not just artists. Like, they have everyday lives, you know, and they have jobs
right.
that sometimes kill the creative energy that you have, you know. But, and I love music. It's poetry is mainly what I do nowadays, but I think they go hand in hand. And I think that artists are history tellers. If you want to know the conditions of a people, listen to the music of their time. Mm-hmm. If we wanted to know what the Black community felt like in the 60s, just pull up music from the 60s and you'll get a glimpse of it. People talk about the 90s and the early 2000s being like that golden era, you know, for us. And it's like, yeah, you listen to the music, that's what it feels like. You know, and then you start to see it change, and then you also start to see the community change. So it's not that the music creates the change. The music just tells the story of the change as it happens.
It's reflecting.
Yeah, it's what's just happening. So that, man, music is the most powerful tool I got. So when I go home, that's, you know, that's what kind of mellows me out, you know, because being in Greenwood and sharing the stories that I have to share every day, it's hard, you know, to keep doing that. And so I use comedy and music just as a way to kind of relax and get it all out of my head.
Man, I mean, I guess the way I would describe it is you are Greenwood's griot. In every aspect of what you do, storytelling is a thread that runs through it. But sometimes you do got to just get real and lay out bluntly the reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do want to talk about Black Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And I'll start by saying, so I made a little TikTok video last week where I was explaining how I said Black Wall Street is not Black owned, right? And this lady came for me in the comments because she's been going to the lock shop for years. Mm-hmm. Her family has, you know, had businesses in Greenwood for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And she took offense to that because she was like, you know, there's been Black-owned businesses here forever. And so what I tried to clarify was that I didn't mean that there aren't Black-owned businesses. I meant that the land and the ownership of these buildings isn't in the hands of these Black people.
Yeah.
What's the most shocking thing when you give tours that people always seem to be surprised about?
I say that's a big part of it. They assume, number one, that Greenwood was only Greenwood Avenue. So that one block is all they assume Greenwood was. But also just learning about the land ownership. And I think a shocking fact with that is even in Greenwood's heyday, Greenwood wasn't 100% black owned back then. Mm. So the Bleeker family in New York, they owned pieces of land. The difference was it was black ran and black controlled. So even though back then, if you lived in Tulsa, if you were an immigrant coming into Tulsa, they didn't necessarily want you in the city limits of Tulsa either. So they would move to the Greenwood District too. Mm-hmm. And so they had opportunities to get land and things like that. So I think that Greenwood not being black owned is a problem. And it's a problem because of what you can do when you own the land that you have versus always having to ask permission. But Greenwood was actually supposed to be what the entire United States markets itself as being. Mm. And so I think that that's the trouble. Like, we look at, well, there's black owned businesses here. It's like, yes, but none of us can leverage equity to scale up, to purchase new property. None of us get that. And so then you look at it like, well, some of the people who own it now, they bought it fair and square. So me playing devil's advocate in my own head, I'm always like, well, if I paid $30 million to buy and develop a piece of land and then I didn't do anything illegal to get it, how could people tell me I'm just supposed to give it away? Like, who's giving me that $30 million back? You know, and so I can kind of see both sides of it. The thing that I don't like is there are pieces of land that are represented as black owned that are not. And it's like, hey, look, if you own land in Greenwood and you're not a part of trying to build that community up, you need to go. Right. So hiding behind like, oh, no, these people own it. It's like, no, they don't. And we know that. And so I think that I'm the one that doesn't mind getting in trouble. So me saying like, no, I don't agree with that. You know, it's, if you're going to be in Greenwood, black, white, green, or purple, Greenwood's rules need to be followed, which is Greenwood is a place of collaboration and mm-hmm. commerce. So if you're not collaborating on Greenwood, I don't care if you're black or not, you got to go. Because that's not, you know, that's not what it is. You know, and I was once, there's a business, newer business owner on Greenwood who told me that they moved to Greenwood. And the reason I was struggling was they were like, you're not a shark. And we have, she was like, it's too many sharks out here. So you got to learn to be a shark. And so I went home and I was thinking about it. And I was like, okay, so the choices are become a shark or get eaten. Those are the choices. So I said, you know what? Why not just learn to swim with sharks? Like, I don't like having to pick lesser of two evils. I don't do it. Like, not making a decision is a decision. So I just decided, you know what? I'll create the Greenwood that I want to see. I'll create the Greenwood that I think people come here to see. And people either get in line with it or they won't. Mm. But either way, I won't let it run me off. Because at the end of the day, what do? If you say that, okay, well, the land's not black owned, so should we all pack up and leave? Because if all of the black owned businesses close and we all relocate somewhere else, historic Greenwood won't have even black businesses in it anymore. So the tourists and the people who come here, I see the way Greenwood's history changes people's lives and their perception of even themselves, not just black people. Like, I see it when I give tours of it. So those people would then come and they would see a Starbucks instead of a Black Wall Street liquid lounge. So do they still leave here feeling as inspired and empowered as they do because they saw a liquid lounge? No. So then the other side of it is you'll pay rent. You won't be able to use the equity. So now I think that some of the landowners in Greenwood, if it's equitable, contributing to the block is not a hard ask. But I actually had to look into history and say, what have we really asked for in Greenwood that mm-hmm. someone has said no to? I can't find anything. So it's like, we can't say that, oh, well, no one's doing anything for Greenwood. It's like, well, what did you ask for? Because if we're expecting these people to come up with something, we would be upset by that too. Imagine if OSU said, you know what, we came up with what collaboration looks like for y'all.
Yeah.
We would be upset. But then we haven't come up with, what do we want OSU Tulsa to do? And so that's because we're all in silos down in Greenwood. We're not together enough to have one ask. Because if that ask happened, you'll have a third of the block saying one thing, another third of the block saying something else, and then another third of the block who just don't want to be a part of it. And if I'm the entity that's supposed to be collaborating, I don't want to be involved in drama. So I'll wait until y'all figure it out.
Right.
And then when y'all come to me with an ask, we can figure it out. It's the same with the baseball stadium. They ain't going nowhere. So what do we want them to do? And until we put that type of pressure on them to where as a tour guide, I can say, hey, we asked the Drillers and FC Tulsa to do blank and they did it. Well, then that's a story that shows they're being community partners. If I say that we asked them to do blank and they completely refused, that's a whole different conversation that these tourists and these people who come in, they can leverage their influence to say, hey, we're not supporting that until y'all meet the needs of the community that you're in. Because at the end of the day, you can't make anybody sell. You can't make anybody do anything, but what you can do is have an ask. And so I think most other people dance around that. Like they're afraid to say anything about, I mean, really any of the quote unquote ecosystems. I'm not afraid of ecosystems because, to be honest, they don't pay me. They're not responsible for my quality of life. And so I also understand that they are responsible for some people's quality of life. And so it's like, publicly, I have one way to think about it. Privately, or not even private, semi-privately. If you're in the coffee shop, I'll say everything I think. Because in the coffee shop, that's my home. That's my safe haven where I can say what I want. But I also understand that things that the words we use and the things we say have consequences, not just for ourselves. But on that particular block, again, if you don't have the Greenwood spirit, you're not operating the way Greenwood was intended to run, I don't care what you look like, you don't belong there. And that energy could go to Utica Square. Mm-hmm. Utica Square doesn't have a history of collaboration. They have a history of commerce. That's fine. And if all you think about is commerce, that's the perfect spot for you. But when you come here, yeah, we're here to collaborate. You know, so Black Wall Street wasn't one business. Black Wall Street wasn't this one big pillar. It was a collection of small businesses that work together, mm-hmm. that had an idea of what community looks like. So it's disheartening. That's probably the shocking part about it is when people find out, wait, it wasn't 100% Black owned. Like, no, it wasn't back then and it definitely ain't now. But what they had back then was they understood that, again, you got to think about it. Black people were looking at other immigrants coming into Tulsa and saying, look, if they don't want you, come over here. That's the story of Black people in America, Black people in Africa, like African descendants all over the world. That's the way our communities have always worked. They've always been inclusive mm-hmm. of whoever. You oppressed too? Come on over here. And so to think that the people at that time didn't operate the way the rest of us already did is crazy. But I think that people who came into Greenwood, they understood that and they saw the heart of the community that was there. So they were contributors. They were collaborators on the block. Not, well, I'm just come over there and get my money and then get up out of here.
Right. I'm here to get mines and that's it. Yeah.
Nah, they live there too. So that, you know, should be a requirement, not just in Greenwood, but just any neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Do you really want people owning property in your neighborhood that take all the revenue 20 miles away? No, because it don't help us. At the end of the year, when that tax assessment is done, we need to see that these tax dollars are being spent here, not that they're just being generated here and leaving. So that's not just Greenwood. That's all the downtown. That's every district that you're in. Your housing property, it fully depends on that tax revenue. So you want a new park, got to be able to show that money's being spent in your area. Otherwise, there's no funding for that. So we can't show that because once the dollar is spent, it leaves. Mm-hmm. So since it's not housed in that community, we don't reap the benefits of it, you know? So, yeah, it's catch 22, man. Yeah. It's always something. But I think that's why I love the block. It's like my own version of love and hip hop down there, you know?
Well, and I want to end it with this. How do we reclaim the spirit of Greenwood? And what is the vision that we need to all get behind to reclaim Black Wall Street?
Man, you starting by no longer being flies, turning to bees. So my granny used to say Black people used to be bees and made no sense to me because I'm allergic to bees. So I'm like, but
I used to have a phobia of bees.
Yeah, they scared me. But Bobby Eaton Sr., Papa Eaton, told me this story and it made it make sense. And he said that there's this old enslaved man who's driving a buggy and he's taking master to town. Mm-hmm. And he sees this fly that's picking at this scab on his horse's ear. So he stops the buggy and he grabs his whip and he cracks the fly, kills the fly. So master says, John, you surely is good with that whip. So John says, yeah, I reckon I get good practice. So they keep going. All of a sudden, master yells, John, stop the buggy. So John stops the buggy and master says, John, how long you been working for me? John says, well, I was 42, so I reckon I've been working for you for about 42 years now. So he says, well, John, I'm willing to bet you your freedom you can't hit that one bee from here. So master points at this one bee circling his hive. So John looks at the bee. He says, well, master, looks like I was going to be a slave for the rest of my days because I don't hit them. And he said, well, why not? He said, well, them's organized. So when they say black people used to be bees, all it meant was every bee in the hive knows it dies if it stings you. But because you killed one bee, they were all willing to die to protect the rest of them. We became more like flies to where if you kill one fly for trying to get on your burger, what happens? Another fly comes right over there and dies for that same thing. You ain't never been attacked by flies for attacking one. It's siloed. It's all by itself. It's broken up. And so the Greenwood spirit wasn't that way. When Dick Rowland was arrested, J.B. Stafford, 160 armed black men, Dick Rowland didn't have 160 armed family members. So these were people who didn't have a family tied to this kid, but they understood that we can't let him die down there. And so even knowing we could potentially lose everything, and eventually did, they still went down and did it. You know, and so that spirit of, you know what, you from here, you one of ours, we protect you. That's Greenwood spirit. Before you ever get to commerce, you know, like, that's really what community is, communication, commerce, and unity, right? So if you have commerce and communication, but you don't have unity, you're not gonna mobilize anybody. So we got to get behind just the simple fact that we're all on that block for the same reason. That's what we should be there for. Mm-hmm. And it's to show people that collaboration is what builds areas like Greenwood. You don't get a Greenwood with one person controlling everything, right? O.W. Gurley didn't name it Gurley Town. It was Greenwood. Mm-hmm. And Greenwood was a place that people could look up. It was an energy. It was a way of thinking, you know, because Greenwood's motto was in East St. Louis. It's in Pine Bluff. It was in Detroit, Chicago, Philly, Oscarville, Rosewood. Wilmington, Durham, like, so there were versions of Greenwood all over. And then even in Oklahoma, Boley, Taft, Rennie'sville, like, they right. may have been smaller, but it was the same model. All of those people worked together. So working together don't mean they all got along. You couldn't tell me every person in Greenwood was friends. Like, I refuse to believe that. That's not the way humans work. But they all had a common goal. And bees have a common goal. Keep the queen alive. Make honey. The ecosystem don't work without them. You know, we get rid of bees, we in some serious trouble around here, right? And so that's how every community has to be. So that Greenwood spirit is meant for people to collaborate with people who want to see the same type of success you want to see.
Yeah.
You know, and I do believe Greenwood was unapologetically itself. Was it a perfect community? Nope. But they handled their issues internally. I remember seeing that there was a rule of the most powerful people in Greenwood never argue publicly. So privately, they probably squared up a few times, yeah. But publicly they had a pact. And that reminds me of a proverb that says, when two elephants fight, only the grass gets hurt. So we can be at the top arguing, bickering. From everything from the state of Black Tulsa to all those different things are cool, but the people that we met and talked about aren't in the room. So what the everyday Black Tulsan experiences is not what Cody Ransom experiences. So Cody Ransom doesn't get to decide what those people get. Those people need to be at the table. And if they're here, I can say, hey, I know how to execute. You know what you need. Let's collaborate and get that done. Not, you know, you see it all the time. There's a video on YouTube you can watch that tells you, look, if you want to get rich, all you got to do just have an 800 credit score, go to the bank, take out $3 million, buy 15 properties, and boom, you just created generational wealth. But I don't got no 800 credit score. So you lost me in the very beginning. And the reason they said it's so easy is because they're speaking from a platform that they've already gotten to. You already have an 800 credit score. So this is quick and easy. But to the person that has a 425, they feel like, oh, well, that's all impossible because I don't have step one done. And that means that it was, that concept was built from the top down, not from the ground up. So, you know, just understand that that's the way Greenwood was modeled. I've never seen a building built from the top up, top down. It's always from the bottom up. So those people down there that we overlook every day, those are the people that are going to build it. You know, we may have the know-how or access to the resource, but, you know, I saw it at Oasis when it first opened. I saw a whole crate full of eggplants. I eat eggplant. But I was thinking, how many people around here actually eat eggplant? So that tells me you probably didn't poll the community about what they actually eat. So you just wasted money. Because these are going to go bad. And so if you would have asked them what they eat, or give them recipes to cook with eggplant. And so now when you teach me how to use it, you show me that this is something useful to have in my kitchen. That's a collaboration. Hey, I've got an idea. What do you think about it? Try this. Now we have something. But if it's just, here, y'all need to eat more lion's mane, mushroom, and eggplant, they're just going to go somewhere else. You know, so that's it, man. Greenwood is exactly what you're doing. You know, empowering people to tell their stories. This is a collaborative thing. Like, podcasts don't just happen because you sat down with a microphone and made it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, someone had to know every piece of it. And the stuff you don't know, someone got to help you with that.
Right.
You know, and so having that, like, systems make things work. Greenwood was a system. You need it. I got it here. And then when I need something and you got it here, we can do commerce, but we gotta be bees before we get to commerce. You know, the honey doesn't come until the hive is built.
Look, it's gonna take me a while to go back and review every proverb you just gave, because every single one was fire. And you know, I think your grandma was absolutely right. And it's time for us to become bees again. Mm-hmm. Cody Ransom, thank you so much for joining the podcast.
And thank you, brother.
Appreciate you.
For this week's Community Spotlight, I share a message from Samuel Sinyangwe, a California-based researcher and founder of Mapping Police Violence. Trump has dismantled the federal police misconduct database, leaving Mapping Police Violence as one of the few national databases remaining. Hear what he had to say.
There was this emerging ecosystem at the time. And what I did was, one, built off of that to be able to create a systematic way to find these articles and information. And two, began to add context and analysis and visualization and mapping to begin to not only have a list or a spreadsheet online, but to tell a story about police violence, how it was impacting communities, how it was impacting different cities, different states, how people, even in terms of policy, how what efforts were being used to fight back and how that actually might or might not have made a difference over time. So that was sort of the genesis of it. You know, over the years, it's been a decade since launching Mapping Police Violence. And now we have a lot more data than we had before. We have a nonprofit organization, 501c3 nonprofit called Mapping Police Violence. We're national in scope and, you know, really have begun to expand our analysis further, you know, beyond what we recognize is that the deadly police violence is the tip of the iceberg. And that for every case where somebody's killed by police, there are as many as 300 other incidents where the police used violence against somebody and that person survived. And so, like, the full picture of police violence is much broader and impacts way more people than even the existing data is suggesting. So I think that that's an important note, that the work is ongoing and we're continuing to expand our analysis and understanding about how police violence impacts communities.
That's all for now. Thank you for joining us on In Depth with Dion. Watch on YouTube, on Patreon for exclusive and behind-the-scenes content, or listen anywhere you get your podcasts. This episode is presented by the Black Wall Street Times. Special thanks to our producer, Jesse Ulrich. I'm Dion Osborne. Stay woke.